face to face. I think it was William Hague who, when he became Foreign Secretary, declared his intention of having a foreign policy that was clear, focused and effective. And that is really the question I'm posing to our three speakers today. Is it clear, is it focused, and that perhaps most important of all, is it effective? I'm not going to take too much time in introducing them because you know them very well indeed. On my far right, who's going to speak first, Jack Straw, who was not only Foreign Secretary but also Home Secretary and just about everything else in the Cabinet aside from those two really relevant ones. On my immediate right, I have Sir Ian Campbell, who was the leader of the Liberal Democrats. And on my left, I have Sir Malcolm Rifkin, who, as you know, was Foreign Secretary and is currently the Chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament. I'm going to ask each of them to speak for 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the floor as usual, and I will close the meeting at 2 o'clock on the dot. First of all, I'm going to ask Jack Straw.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. I think as everybody knows... Michael. But thank you, Malcolm, as well. And Bing. That was a good start. Foreign policy in the UK has tended to be bipartisan, and certainly the debates are a lot more serious and intelligent than some of those I sat through recently on domestic policy. And so it's in that vein that I make this contribution. The exam question is the foreign policy of the coalition government clear, focused and effective? The first point I'd make is that in foreign policy, you don't really have a coalition foreign policy, but a conservative foreign policy. And I don't say that in any pejorative way. If you've got a majority party and a coalition as you have, it's essential that the Foreign Minister and the Prime Minister are from the same party, in my view, and broadly speaking, following the same agenda. And that's bound to mean, in this case, that it is a conservative foreign policy. And I'm also not being disobliging to Ming, but with some minor exceptions, I don't see much of an element of Liberal Democrat policy in this, in the way, say, that you do very distinctively in respect, say, of pensions and other issues like that. The second point I would make is that within this conservative envelope, I think you can now discern two sets of foreign policies, depending on which side of Downing Street is in the lead. And essentially what you've got is European foreign policy being led from the north side of the street, that's this side, and the rest of the world, broadly speaking, being led from the other side of the street. And I think that for clear and focused and effective, it's the south side of the street which gets higher marks than the north side of the street by quite some margin. Let me just run through the rest of the world issues. As ever, it's the wider Middle East which is preoccupying. And this is one of those areas where I think it's these days very difficult for Britain, certainly on its by itself, to make really significant impact. We did inadvertently, although I was pleased that we did, make a real worldwide impact on the 29th of August last year when the British House of Commons, on a cross-party basis, decided not to intervene militarily in Syria. Now, there are some who say that that has led, and I know it's a view shared by the British government, to Assad being strengthened. There may be something in that, but it is equally possible that the kind of destruction of the infrastructure of Syria, which would have taken place, further infrastructure of the central infrastructure, might have led to the secular opposition achieving dominance, but equally could have led to the Islamist, jihadist, Salafist opposition achieving greater dominance than it has. And that was an example, in my judgment, where policy was not very clearly thought through. And for the life of me, I've yet to have an explanation as to why Parliament was called back only 4 days before it was to return in any event. That gave a sense of panic to the situation. It was very unclear, both here, but above all in the US, what the strategy was. And I remember being amazed that President Bush used the metaphor, but you know, as a master of language, he chooses these metaphors, that what he was seeking by these strikes was a shot across the bow. Well, we have a very distinguished admiral in our presence today, doing brilliant work on the history of the Royal Navy on Radio 4, I advertise. A shot across the bow is just that. It's one that doesn't cause any damage. That wasn't quite what President Bush had in mind, but did suggest... Obama had in mind, but did suggest... It's senior moments, but I've had President Bush on my brain this morning in respect of Iran. It wasn't quite what President Obama had in mind, and I'd say I'm glad that we, in a sense, saved him from that policy and the British government. I thought on Iraq, I thought William Hague was both statesmanlike and accurate in the approach he took yesterday. On Iran, which has been a preoccupation of mine since I first became Foreign Secretary, I'm one of those people who don't believe that Iran is a serious adversary. I'm aware of Iran's capacity. I'm aware of its potential to build a nuclear weapon system. But I've always believed that it's in our interest to build up relations with Iran, and I also know, this is why I had President Bush on my mind, that the progenitor, the begetter of President Ahmadinejad and the Conservatives in power was a way in which President Bush pulled the rug from under the feet of President Khatami 5 months after President Khatami had been very courageous in both expressing moral support for the victims of 9/11, but also gave us a huge amount of overt and covert support to get the Taliban out of Afghanistan. Well, that was then, and thankfully, as we know today, there's been an announcement from William Hague of the reopening of the embassy. I hope that happens quickly, because I saw the embassy buildings in January when I was in Tehran. It could happen quickly, and we then get back into better relations with Iran, including on trade. Just say on trade, really interesting that EU trade has gone down by a third since sanctions bit. UK trade has dropped by three quarters, but hey, and I can explain why in questions. US trade has increased year by year while sanctions have bitten and is now twice the level of UK trade. Discuss. I'm concerned about the lack of capacity we have as a result of the Strategic Defence Review, and I wonder whether that could have affected our ability to assist further in Nigeria. I remain, as so many do, continuing to be concerned about the situation in Palestine, which I saw earlier in the year, and I think the British government under William Hague and David Cameron have been better than we were in being critical of the Israelis, but we still need to see far tougher pressure on the Israelis not to carry on basically stealing land which belongs directly to the Palestinians. I could say a good deal more about relations with India and China, except to say, but the election of Prime Minister Modi does provide us with an opportunity, strangely, to build much better relations, and I hope that is taken. Last area where, say, on dealing with the strategy from the north side of the street on the European Union, there are, frankly, has been muddle in respect of our position on the EU. You could take a view, which I don't, that the best course for the United Kingdom is to see it exit from the European Union, and what you need for that is the British people's consent. You could take the view, which I do, which is that the better course is to stay in the European Union for a myriad of commercial and foreign policy reasons, and then to work to help reform the European Union, and the wind is behind us on that and the way in which it wasn't and has been since the euro crisis. I think we're ending up with the worst of almost all worlds in this situation, where the government plainly wants us to stay in the European Union, but its actions, including not having a referendum 2 years ago, which they could have done, but having a referendum in 2017, simply feeds the UKIP beast. And we will see, an illustration, we're likely to see it, an illustration of the lack of coherence and influence we have over what happens to Jean-Claude Juncker. It's a great irony that I remember being told by German foreign ministers and also by the German press that Juncker was not their favourite diplomat. He was the favourite of President Chirac, but not the Germans. Well, that's changed. But I don't think it's a good idea for us to see Jean-Claude Juncker heading up the Commission. But as a result of, I think, infelicitous footwork by the Prime Minister, he's pushed Merkel into a position where I think she didn't want to be, and it's anybody's guess as to whether we do or we don't end up with him. But it's the result of this, in any event, would be a loss of British influence. So that's, say, my brief balance sheet of the pluses coming from the south side of the street, but the minuses from the north side of the street. Thank you very much.
Michael and Malcolm, it sounds like a comedy duo on the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, doesn't it? And as for the notion that the Foreign Secretary always has to be of the same party as the Prime Minister, or in the German case, the President, may I remind you that Hans-Dietrich Genscher managed to survive for a very long time, in spite of the fact that he was by no means a member of either of the parties that formed government. I arrived, actually, with a lot of sort of conventional stuff that you've all heard, but I'm really provoked, or stimulated, perhaps a better way to put it, by what Jack has to say. And I'm going to go straight to Europe, because it is, of course, the area in which I think you will find the most disagreement among the three of us. I think that the government has been wholly inept in its approach to this, and it does seem to me to represent a quite fundamental failure of understanding as to how the European Union works. It works through alliances. It works through consensus. And I sometimes think that our adversarial system of politics actually militates very strongly against a proper understanding of how things are to be determined. And I think in particular, the government has been unwise to create circumstances in which Angela Merkel is embarrassed by this government. First of all, the Conservatives left the European People's Party, and she was deeply upset by that. Relations began to be improved to some extent. Then we've had the question of Juncker, which is, however it is resolved, will have caused her some embarrassment. And the most recent thing is that the Conservative group in the European Parliament has formed up with a rather right-wing element of conservatism, which the Germans do not wish to have any part of. And the point really I want to make is that if I'm right about the proposition that you have to make alliances, then when you have someone who self-evidently wants to be in alliance with us, those who were present at the speech she made in the Royal Gallery before both Houses of Parliament, heard someone who, dying to have an alliance with us, was very concerned to ensure that common interests between ourselves and Germany, and in particular in the single market, should be forged and, so far as possible, be progressed. And I think, therefore, that element of government foreign policy it has been defective, and it's going to get worse. Because the pressure now on the backbenches of the Conservative Party to solidify, if you like, the commitment to an in-out referendum. The person who won the ballot for private members' bills the other day has already said that's what he's going to try and do. And it seems to me that that simply will distract the Prime Minister in particular, and indeed the Foreign Office, from looking at these external challenges which are of such enormous significance to us at the moment. Can I just say that I think you have to accept, I remember Douglas Hurd saying, you've got to accept that we're now a medium-ranking economic power. Well, 4 or 5 years ago, you might not even have chosen that description for us. But we have to accept that although our aspirations and ambitions may be very considerable, the truth is that in many significant issues, like, for example, Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq, we are subordinate to the United States. And we're all sitting, and I don't exempt myself from this criticism, in relation to Iraq, we're all sitting waiting to see what the president will do. And the question then will be, do we go along with that, or do we disagree with it? And since we're in circumstances in Iraq which have made us all think back to 2012-2013, the proposition, my ally, right or wrong, would seem to me to be as dangerous in 2014 as indeed it was then. But I do agree with Jack that William Hague yesterday in the House of Commons was both measured and carefully judged in what he said. And I don't think anyone now believes that the invasion of Iraq is the sole cause of the present disarray in Iraq, nor indeed that it can be excluded altogether. It's facile, in my view, to offer either of these propositions. The point I want to make is this, that, and here Jack, to a large extent, anticipated it in talking about the Strategic Defence Review and its outcome. Because although it's quite true that you can go down to a certain level, and at that level, you can mount an operation for 6 weeks or even 6 months. But the one thing you don't have is resilience. You can't go on with such an operation because you simply don't have the numbers to sustain it. Now, what does that do? That immediately has consequences for the foreign policy choices of the Prime Minister and the government. Now, I don't sit on the National Security Council, but I'm willing to bet that from time to time there are discussions about what might or might not be done, which are heavily, the results of which are heavily influenced by the notion, well, we might start this, but we certainly would not be able to finish it. And I think the relationship between military capability and foreign policy options is one which we have allowed to slide away. Going through a period of austerity, of course, no objection to that. But at least the primary obligation of any government is to protect the lives and the property and the interests of its citizens. And if you get to a certain level of defence spending, then the fulfilment of that obligation becomes very difficult. Or it can only be achieved by being much more introspective and being less inclined to the kind of role which we have fulfilled in the past and which the public still largely expects. I've got a mnemonic for you, USI, Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq. And I suppose you could say I squared because it has Iran as well. These are the issues which are going to dominate foreign policy for the foreseeable future. Let me take the issue of Ukraine. I think that the attitude and the behaviour of President Putin signals very, very clearly the end of the sort of post-Gorbachev consensus that we had between Russia and ourselves. It's a reflection of that Russian, traditional Russian feeling, no one takes us sufficiently serious. We ought to be respected more than we are. And of course it's offered against the background in Russia of very substantial economic difficulty. And that's where the European Union, again, seems to me to have a very significant role to play, because, of course, sanctions from the European Union they've so far had a considerable effect, but they could have the effect of achieving one, at least, of my alternatives. The first is Putin won't come back to talk until he's satisfied or he's forced to. And when he's satisfied is something outside our control. But we can bring him back if the strength of our sanctions is sufficient and if our determination across Europe as a whole to enforce them is as strong as it should be. And so it's rather interesting, isn't it, that As we come to these problems that I've just referred to, the EU again and again comes up. And one of the points I want to make about Putin is this. Just remember what it was which triggered the adventure in Crimea. It was the fact that Ukraine was demonstrating, albeit under a pretty corrupt president, but it thought its future ought to be with Europe rather than to the East. And what that tells me is that from the point of view of Putin, nothing would be more to his satisfaction were the European Union to be engaged in a period of introspection, and indeed countries like the United Kingdom should choose to leave. Because I'm firmly of the view that the political and economic stability of the European Union has been based on two things. First of all, on NATO, the bedrock of defence, but secondly, on the political and economic strength of the European Union. Both have served to keep the peace. And if you are Putin and you want to disrupt what he sees as a challenge from the European Union and indeed Europe in general, then you would certainly be satisfied if you thought, putting it colloquially, the wheels were beginning to come off. And as part of all of that, of course, as Jack has already said, there are plenty of people who want to be our allies, and we should do everything we possibly can to ensure that we can keep on the same side as them. Syria, very, very quickly. What the House of Commons voted for last September was for nothing, because there was a motion in the name of the government, and that was defeated. There was an amendment in the name of the opposition, and that was defeated. The House of Commons voted to do nothing. Although it's worth reminding ourselves that the government motion wanted to refer the whole issue to the United Nations and specifically made a provision that no military action could be taken without a further vote. So it wasn't that we did something, it was that we didn't do something, hastily seized upon, of course, by President Obama. And that's that brings me then to the whole question of the extent of dependency on the United States. It used to be called the pivot. The Americans didn't like the reaction. The use of the word pivot meant or was interpreted as, and now it's called rebalancing. There will come a time when the United States, either under the influence of its left or of its right, will say we can no longer afford and we're no longer obliged to continue to maintain the level of defense expenditure in Europe, because the Europeans, for too long, have had a free ride. And that really is a challenge of the most enormous significance for us, because if I have argued, as I have, that the post-Gorbachev settlement has been disrupted, then, of course, the defence settlement and the political settlement, to which I've already referred, would also be disrupted by any weakening in the transatlantic alliance. And if you are President Putin, a weakening in the transatlantic alliance would be a bonus above and beyond any disarray in the European Union.
Finally, I'm going to ask Malcolm Rifkin to talk.
Thank you very much indeed. Jack, I forgive you for confusing me with Michael when you subsequently confused Barack Obama with George Bush. Whether Obama will be as forgiving or not, it's not for me to say. Can I say, Jack and I, of course, have both served as Foreign Secretary. It's sometimes an advantage not being Foreign Secretary. Harold Macmillan, who briefly served in that post, in his memoirs said that foreign ministers are always in a cruel dilemma. Their speeches hover between the cliché and the indiscretion. They are either dull or dangerous. In my experience, they're sometimes both, but that's another matter. Let me deal with some of the points that have been raised. First of all, the overall achievement or lack of achievement of the government with regard to foreign policy. In the time available, let me just concentrate on one specific point. I think that William Hague deserves an enormous credit for restoring the relevance and strength and autonomy of the Foreign Office as the lead department on foreign policy. Because the reality is, under successive prime ministers, Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair particularly, the Foreign Office became an adjunct, the Foreign Secretary became an adjunct to a prime ministerial lead on that issue. And I think David Cameron and William Hague have got exactly the right relationship. Prime ministers have to be involved, but of course the bulk of the work has to be with the professionalism and expertise of the Foreign Office. Ming, you mentioned a lot of what you said, Ming. I agreed with you in terms of the United States, but I don't think you're right to imply that somehow there's some subordination, some subservience to the United States. Of course, for the last 70 years, the United States has been a much more powerful country. It's been not just a superpower, it's been described as a super-duper power, and therefore it would not be surprising that it takes the lead on most issues. But successive governments of all parties have from time to time strongly disagreed with the United States, and the Americans have respected that. Margaret Thatcher did so with Reagan on Soviet gas pipelines and on the future of nuclear weapons. Harold Wilson famously did on Vietnam. John Major did on Bosnia, and so forth. And one of the big mistakes of Tony Blair was to believe that you couldn't disagree with the United States without somehow damaging our overall partnership, and that simply isn't true. On the question of Europe, which my two colleagues have mentioned, of course it's going to be a hell of a challenge for David Cameron, if we are re-elected at the next election, to achieve what he set out to achieve. But, you know, I served as a very junior minister under Margaret Thatcher when she was battling for the UK rebate. At that time, she started without a single ally, not one country, not surprisingly, keen to give back to the United Kingdom billions of euros worth of rebate. David Cameron starts with quite significant different position. He has the Swedes, he has the Danes. The Dutch Prime Minister has said how the days of ever closer union are over. Others, including President Hollande, have said there's a need for reform. Now that is a different intellectual and political climate. Of course it will need compromise and it will need diplomatic skills. But I noticed, you know, of course, occasionally the differences with Angela Merkel are there, as has been pointed out. But just a few days ago we had Angela Merkel, the Dutch Prime Minister, the Swedish Prime Minister, and David Cameron in a boat together at the end of a day of very warm and intimate discussions. That's, you know, and they didn't fall out of the boat. That's the crucial point. The reality is you're dealing with prime ministers and presidents, all of whom have their domestic constituencies, and the essence of Europe is not that everybody agrees or everybody is nice to one another. It is that they all understand that they have to come up with a solution that both preserves the European Union, but is also defensible to their own electorates at the same time. Let me comment briefly on some of the main issues that we're dealing with at the moment. The statement today by William Hague on Iran. A very important statement. One must welcome, one should welcome, the resumption of diplomatic relations, the attempts by both America and Britain to achieve some sort of more normal relationship with Iran. However, and there is a however, I think, first of all, we need to reassure our closest allies in the Middle East, both the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and Israel, that we're quite realistic. This is not some assumption, some naive assumption, that somehow the fundamental differences that still remain between Iran's worldview and its foreign policy objectives and the way it carries out these objectives is somehow going to disappear or morph into something cozy with the West. If you want a comparison, I think the most realistic comparison we can expect or anticipate is that if things go well, we will end up with a relationship, not just Britain, but the United States as well, a relationship with Iran that is pretty similar to the relationship the West had with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Diplomatic relations, trade in a normal way, and cultural contacts, occasionally areas of practical cooperation that even in the midst of all the disagreements we could carry out. That would be a big plus compared to where we've been in the last 25 years. But it is far from being a cozy, warm relationship. That is not possible unless the Iranian government changes its fundamental worldview and its foreign policy in a pretty material way. Secondly, on Iraq, the events of the last few days are obviously pretty horrifying. But I don't think there's a real issue about Western direct involvement. Of course, there will be diplomatic initiatives. Quite rightly, there will be humanitarian initiatives. The United States might choose to give some extra weaponry to the Iraqi government. That all doesn't make much difference. The reality is that what you have are insurgents in the north. They happen to be jihadi terrorists. They cannot be destroyed in the short to medium term. But once they try to control large swathes of territory, then conventional military means can expel them from that territory. And my belief is that the Iraqi government, which has up to 100,000 troops, I know not all of them are particularly keen to use their weapons and to fight, but, you know, we're talking about a huge military imbalance of aircraft, artillery, of helicopters, as well as very large numbers of troops. And in a conventional conflict, to expel people from a particular bit of territory like Mosul, that I do not believe will take them, it may take them a few weeks, but it's something they have within their power. But that won't bring stability to Iraq, and nor will Western involvement, directly or indirectly. The only thing that's going to bring stability to Iraq is a Iraqi government of genuine national unity that gives the Sunnis a proportionate role in the government of Iraq, and therefore gives them a vested interest in not being tempted by ISIS or other similar organizations of a Sunni background to distance themselves from the Iraqi government. I don't think Maliki can deliver that, but that's what Iraq needs. And we can encourage that diplomatically. We can say any help to the Iraqi government will be dependent on them moving in that direction. But let's fool ourselves that there's any further than that. Finally, if I could comment on Ukraine and on Russia. Crucial issue, but let's be quite clear. Putin ultimately didn't give a damn about Crimea. He didn't need to annex Crimea for any geostrategic reason, because Sebastopol was what mattered, and he already had control of Sebastopol, the naval base, and the military presence in Sebastopol gave him de facto control of what happened in Crimea anyway. He annexed Crimea because he risked going down in Russia as the president who had lost Ukraine when Yanukovych fell. He had to reestablish his political position, and therefore the annexation of Crimea was an opportunistic act and one that was consistent with his wider foreign policy. Ultimately, this is not even about Ukraine. It is about Russia as an imperial power. And it's not going back to Lenin in 1917. It's going back to Peter the Great 300 years ago. Somebody once said the difference between the British Empire and the Russian Empire was that Britain had an empire, Russia was an empire. And it still thinks in those terms. And that's why Ukraine is important. Now, I have one final point to make, and that is my criticism of the British government, not just the British government, but in this context today, the British government, is I believe their initial response to the pressure on Crimea was wrong and was inadequate and insufficient. The idea that visa controls and freezing assets of a couple of dozen Russian individuals would have the slightest impact on Putin's wider geostrategic foreign policy was naive and absurd. I can only assume that they only went that far because they couldn't get political agreement to go further. I do believe Russia has an Achilles heel. It's its oil and its gas. Tsar Alexander, 110, 120 years ago, said Russia only has two friends, its army and its navy. Well, Putin only has two friends, oil and gas. And that is the area of weakness in terms of the Russian economy, plus their dependence on world financial markets, a combination of financial sanctions and trade sanctions, which are now being threatened and which are having its effect. One of the reasons why Russia hasn't gone into Ukraine is partly because the Ukrainians at last are fighting back, and that concentrates the mind wonderfully, and secondly, because they know that financial and trade sanctions would now be unavoidable. So I think mistakes were made, but I'm relieved that at this stage in this process, we are showing the kind of determination, at least I hope we are, that is going to be necessary if Putin, who's not a Hitler, he's not a demagogue, he's not a psychopath or trying to control the whole of Europe, but he is an opportunist Russian nationalist who wants to create something of the Russian Empire that was lost when the Soviet Union was dismantled. Well, that may be persuasive in Russia. It cannot be acceptable in Europe that the borders of Europe and of European states since 1945 shall again be determined by military annexation in the way that we saw in Crimea. And that's a big responsibility for the British government and for the West as a whole.